You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a health reporter about the group insurance board meeting today, where a decision on self-insurance for state workers was postponed for the time being.
First, we want to know, what's the best book you read in 2016, whether it was new or just new to you? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What book do you wish you'd read this year? What new book maybe grabbed your interest?
Radhika Jones is with us now to talk about her picks for the best books of 2016. She's the editorial director of books for the New York Times. She joins us from a studio at the New York Times. Radhika, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, would you say that 2016 was a good year for books?
I would say it was a great year for books. I personally found that it was a great year for books that felt very timely. So you could be paying a lot of attention to the news and the stories that were sort of coming up out of actual human experience and find a lot of those same themes and fears and anxieties reflected in not just the nonfiction of the year, but also the fiction.
And when it comes to a great year for books, for timely books, you're saying, how do you narrow it down to 10 books, 5 fiction and 5 nonfiction?
Well, I should say that the New York Times best books list, even though a lot of these books happen to be very timely, is less about their newsiness than it is about the sheer quality of the books that we're looking at. This is a list that generates a lot of discussion and debate here at the Times in the book section. We look at all of the books that we've reviewed over the year and talk about the author's ambition, about the quality of the reporting in the case of nonfiction, the literary execution in the case of fiction and nonfiction, the sheer power of the storytelling. And so we really do feel that these are the best books of 2016.
Yeah, how heated does that discussion get? There were a lot of heavy hitters that didn't make your top 10 list, including Ann Patchett, Walter Mosley, Annie Proulx. So how into this do you get when you discuss it?
Well, you know, book people are very passionate people. They have strong opinions, and that's great. Look, I feel like all lists are invitations to debate and discuss. So, you know, it's really a great problem to have, to feel that there are a wealth of books from which to choose. But the titles that ended up on our 10 best list, I think, are, I know speaking personally, these are books that I feel very good about pushing on all of my family and friends. So heads up, this is what you're all getting for Christmas.
Talking to Radhika Jones from the New York Times, looking at the 10 best books as reported by the Times of 2016. Let's start getting into some of the, let's start on the fiction side. The Association of Small Bombs. I understand this follows the lives of people affected by a Kashmiri terrorist attack in a Delhi market. So talk about that book. What put that on the list?
This is just an incredibly dramatic and propulsive book. And I think the thing that made it stand out for me when I read it is that it's a book that kind of feels, the event that precipitates it feels a little bit ripped from the headlines. It's a sort of what we would call a small terrorist attack, small scale, about 24 people killed. But the story follows the lives of the people who were affected by this bomb. And as you can imagine, a lost life is a lost life. It doesn't matter if there were 20 or 2,000. And so in this particular attack, two young boys are killed, and we follow the afterlife of their parents and their friend who was on the scene but was not killed, but also notably the people who set the bomb, the terrorists, and we learn about them, their backstories, what happens to them in the future. And it, you know, it forces your imagination maybe into places that you might not want it to go, but that's what makes it ambitious and ultimately extremely powerful.
That's interesting, because as you say, it's ripped from the headlines in many ways, and sadly we see this headline all the time, bombing in market in insert place here. It sounds like it tries to add some humanity behind that story we'd read, feel bad about for a few seconds, and then forget about.
Yeah, I mean, when news events like that become repetitive, you know, it, mm-hmm. it can be difficult even for the most well-meaning, informed citizen of the world to follow that narrative, you know, for even months, let alone years or decades. And so this book kind of shows us what that would be like to be able to follow the aftermath of a devastating event.
Moving on to another book, Colson Whitehead has been around for a long time, turning out great books, and he's got another excellent book on your list. The Underground Railroad is on the list, and it centers on a slave fleeing north on a literal Underground Railroad. That's a part of the novelty of this book. What stood out to you about this one?
Well, it's true, as you say, Colson Whitehead has been an acclaimed novelist for some time now, but this book was very special, even within his own canon. It just had this incredible... He's someone who really writes compellingly about technology and humanity, and sometimes that takes interesting turns. He's written a zombie novel, for example. In this case, he took the metaphor of the Underground Railroad and made it real, made it literal. It's something that you can imagine. I mean, he talked about this when he talked about the book, that many children mistakenly believe that it was a real railroad, that it could transport slaves to freedom. And what was fascinating to me was that not only did he take that step of making it literal and making you understand the territory that would have to be covered for a slave to escape from the Deep South, but he also made it a bit of a time-traveling device. So his protagonist, Cora, an escaped slave, she emerges from the railroad in various of states, but also into various periods of history in the United States. And so it ends up being not just a novel about slavery, as if that wouldn't be enough, but also a novel that encompasses a lot of the African-American experience. And this is something, you know, that I think just has animated a lot of conversation over the last few years in American culture and in American life. So it's an incredibly valuable story, extremely compelling.
Let's move on to another one now. These first two we've talked about, I'm sold. I want to read these. This next one you're going to have to sell me on a little more, though, I think. The North Water, author named Ian McGuire. I understand it's an opium-addicted Irish surgeon, 19th century, ends up on a ship with a psychopath of some sort, really brutally violent, as I understand. I'm not thinking this is something I want to read. What is it that makes that story click?
Are you not a whaling fan?
Well, you
you're
know,
not
in my
into
youth,
whaling
I was,
stories.
Moby Dick may have. I may have
I'm
read
shocked.
Moby Dick at the wrong time, and it turned me off to it. I don't know.
Well, the way that we describe it, it's a picture of a meeting between Joseph Conrad and Cormac McCarthy. Yes, there's
yeah, again,
some.
Again, still not. Sorry.
Well, not all books are for everybody, but.
Well, that's a very good point. Thank you for jumping in.
Sure. What did you like about it?
It's you know, there's something to be said for grimness and bleakness in storytelling. I think for us it really was about the vision that this writer had that was just incredibly steeped in this strange history of this profession and that kind of isolation that it would engender, you know, when you are really with other men, barely more than beasts themselves, out in the elements, doing something that is incredibly elemental in the most real sense of the word. So, again, I think, as with Joseph Conrad, as with Cormac McCarthy, maybe not for everyone, but in a funny way, kind of both very modern and also a little bit of a throwback, and I think that appeals to people.
Is this one of those books that's kind of especially effective if you read it in winter where everything is dark and cold and stark and you've got a little bit of ennui going on and you want to lean into that emotion?
I think it's worth trying for sure. Yes. Cuddle up. You can be somewhere warm and comfortable, unlike the people in this book. So that might bring you a little pleasure.
Well, we're talking right now with Radhika Jones from the New York Times. She's sharing her favorite books of 2016 and the papers. They had a big discussion, decided what was going to be on this 10 best list, and we're hearing about it.
You can see that 10 top picks list linked at the Central Time Facebook page. You can join in with your favorite books of the year or that were new to you this year at 800-642-1234. Do you want to make the case for something as a best book of 2016? What's your favorite one that you read this year? year? Again, new or new to you? And what are you recommending to others? What are you maybe giving to other people for Christmas through the holiday season, or loaning to people hoping to get back someday? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post your suggestions and check out this list on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion right now about the best books of 2016 with Radhika Jones, editorial director of books for The New York Times.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What books would you like to give or receive as a gift this year? What books struck you in 2016 as a cut above? What were some of your favorites? Do you need a recommendation, maybe? Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, find a link to the New York Times list of five fiction, five nonfiction books.
And Radhika, what would your recommendation be from this list if you've got someone you're shopping for this holiday season who loves novels and they're looking for something that's maybe original that they haven't really seen before?
Well, if you're person doesn't mind taking a little bit of a risk, I would say The Vegetarian, which is a novel by a Korean writer translated into English this year. And it's a very simple story. On the face of it, a housewife in Korea wakes up one morning. She's had a very vivid dream, and she has decided, because of this dream, to stop eating meat. So, okay, you know, lots of us make dietary choices in our lives, and some of them are whimsical, and some of them are rooted in something more thoughtful. But what's fascinating about this book is that it becomes this kind of psychological spiral. Her decision changes her relationship with her spouse, with her parents, with her siblings. It changes her relationship to her body, and ultimately to the outside world. And it's just this kind of mesmerizing interior look at a person whose single-mindedness becomes her undoing. In New York, if you're a reader, you usually have a benchmark. If the book makes you miss your subway stop, it's worth passing along. And I missed a couple of stops reading this book. So it's extremely engrossing and different, just very original and different. And one nice thing is that because this book was received well in the States, more of her work will be coming out in English in the near future. So there will be more to come.
It's a subway moment, kind of like those public radio driveway moments we talk about.
That's right.
We'll bring out a caller now. We've got Janet with us in Burlington. Janet, hi.
Hi. So I read three books by a gentleman by the name of Kent Nerburn, N-E-R-B-U-R-N, and all of the books were about his true experiences with an elderly Native American gentleman, and in light of what's been going on out in the Dakotas recently, these books are absolutely fascinating, and he hasn't written enough of them. I highly recommend them.
Janet, thanks for the recommendation. Kent Nerburn. And let's go, Radhika, to some of the nonfiction picks now. We probably won't get to all of them. One close to home made the list. Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. This follows Milwaukee and people living and facing the risk of eviction there. What made that make the top of the list here?
This is just a terrific book about something that we probably don't, a topic we don't know well enough. We don't hear enough of these stories. Matthew Desmond was a sociology student, a graduate student, in 2008, and he took notes on the lives of people who were on the brink of eviction. And the book that results is just incredibly empathetic. It is exhaustively researched and reported, and it brings you into the lives of people whose stories we might just not want to see or not be able to see. So it's incredibly valuable as a piece of reporting about America, and particularly about America in an age of economic anxiety.
Let's take another caller now. We've got John on the line in Middleton. John, hi.
Hi. I read an obscure business novel called The Non-Product Consolidation Operation. It's the funniest business humor book I've ever seen in my life. It's very short, takes about 4 hours to read, and I guarantee if you read it, you'll laugh out loud.
So this is a genre, business humor. I don't know if I've zeroed in on that as a genre before, business humor. So this is the nonprofit, the non-product consolidation operation. Is this a genre that you're aware of, Radhika?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
I was learning along with you. No, although a book that you can read in 4 hours and that will make you laugh a lot, I'm game.
Sounds good. And are there any funny ones that didn't make the list, as long as we're talking about humor books?
Oh, wow. Probably too many to count. There must be a joke in there. I'll think of it after we're done, I'm sure.
Well, Radhika, that does make me think. I mean, this is a fairly heavy list, reading-wise. What do you read for fun, maybe for a break between some of the heavier fare?
Oh, let's see. What do I read for fun? I'll tell you something I read this year. I don't know if you'd call it fun exactly, but it was very soothing. Bear with me. It's not about whaling. It started out not fun because we were hearing so much about the Zika virus. I went back and read Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which was, of course, about DDT and the mosquito. I was so enamored of that book, even though it's such a tough topic, that I went back and read. She wrote this beautiful trilogy about the sea. So I read her 3 books about the sea. And one of them is really all about the tidal line. So it's about all the creatures that live in this zone that's sort of half water, half sand. And I'll tell you, it was just incredibly restful to leave the 24/7 news cycle at the end of the day and spend time through Rachel Carson, this amazing environmental writer, just kind of slowly studying tidal pools along with her. So I recommend some nature writing for anyone who wants to get away from it all.
Mm, that does sound good. Another book taking us back into the heavier territory again, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. It's a book by Jane Mayer, and we did interview her on this program. I remember this interview, and she's writing about the Koch brothers. It took her years to research. What hit home about the writing of this one?
This is a subject that fans of Jane Mayer have obviously been following her on for years. And I think, you know, the savvier the American public gets about elections and the way that they are run, the more transparent those operations become, the more interested people are in, who is funding campaigns, whose agenda is rising to the top and why, who are the people who are writing checks to support certain policy initiatives or agendas. And, you know, she's just the complete master of pulling all of that reporting together and showing you a picture of the foundation, you know, the sort of source of a lot of the issues that we're all wrestling with today. So I think she's absolutely the expert at this point on the Koch brothers and how they have used their fortune to determine a lot of the American political agenda. So to be an informed citizen these days, I think, is to encounter the work of Jane Mayer.
It's Dark Money by Jane Mayer. We're talking to Radhika Jones from the New York Times, looking at the Times' best 10 books of 2016. We'll get to a couple more of them, I think. Staying in nonfiction, now this one's in philosophy. Sarah Bakewell's At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails, the story of some 20th century, mostly, I think, philosophers.
Yes, although I was in it for the cocktails.
Yeah, tell us about that one.
it's one of those sort of terrific moments where you have a group of intellectuals who come together and their whole becomes more than the sum of its parts. But what's striking about Sarah Bakewell's book is that she really is able to engage with a lot of complex philosophy, while at the same time drawing out what's really fascinating and engaging about these characters who did have very outsized lives. So it's sort of fun to be with her, learning about the ways that they thought and how their legacy affects us today.
And you've got one here for people who love memoirs. I'm one of these people. I love memoirs. And it's interesting, this memoir written by Susan Faludi, who we think of as doing sort of feminist journalism. This is a memoir called In the Darkroom. What's that about?
It is so interesting with a writer like Susan Faludi, who we know so well in a certain context, and then she came out with this memoir that really showed a whole other side to her life. She learned that her estranged father had undergone gender reassignment surgery. And he wanted to have a new relationship with her. He wanted to be back in touch with her. He was a man who was full of contradictions, a very, very difficult character, to say the least. And she, you know, really tries to meet her halfway. It's hard to imagine in any circumstances coming to relearn a parent when that parent fundamentally changes. And for someone like Susan Faludi, who has been in certain ways immersed in gender issues her entire life, you can imagine the depth of thought and emotion that she brings to this topic when it involves her own father.
And as you say, this is something not what we would expect from Susan Faludi. She is a good storyteller.
Yeah, and it's just a terrific story. It's a very unique story, and her perspective is very unique.
Well, Radhika, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope everyone has a great reading holiday.
That was Radhika Jones, editorial director of books for The New York Times, and you can check out her list of the best books of 2016 over on the Central Times Facebook page, and hopefully add your own nominations. You've probably been reading during 2016. Tell us what you think. What would be on your top 10 list of 2016?
Yeah, definitely interested in seeing what people think. I think from this list, it's a toss-up for me in the fiction Underground Railroad. Association of Small Bombs looks good. The Vegetarian. I don't know. What would you reach for first?
I'm not sure. I think that the Susan Faludi sounds okay. Pretty intriguing. I also read another great one called The Nest this year, which was fun. It's nice kind of escapist fiction.
Again, share your favorites on the Central Time Facebook page.